Lecture 20, Virgil, Aeneid.
Arma virumque cano, war and a warrior I sing, and so we shall in this lecture. We shall sing of Aeneas, Pius Aeneas, Aeneas the man of duty. We will sing of Virgil's Aeneid. In our last three lectures, we have examined this concept of duty and responsibility and honor as ways in which we live our lives. We have seen most disturbingly, to some of you, that in the 20th century, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, as well as George Orwell, portray the individual as having very little ability to live their life in terms of duty and honor and responsibility that was based upon a concept of conscience, on doing what was right. Orwell showed us in 1984 that the individual like Winston Smith counts for nothing. Whatever feeling of conscience such an individual has, the state can absolutely grind it under more than that, blow it out and replace it by whatever they want. Brainwashing. And Solzhenitsyn would be the first to tell you that it was only God who saved his voice out of all those who perished without mention, remembrance, in the Gulag Archipelago. Three of the books I have chosen as great books from the 20th century are All Quiet on the Western Front, 1984, and the Gulag Archipelago. Pondering that, you might say, those are books about war, the desolation of war, what it does to the soul, and labor camps, and totalitarianism, and what that does to the soul. And I must say to you, that was the great lesson of the 20th century. The 20th century was the greatest democratic age in history, and it led to the two greatest despotisms in history, the Third Reich of Hitler and the Soviet Union of Joseph Stalin. And this greatest democratic age in history led to the most destructive wars in human history. Total wars of World War I and World War II. 11 million dead in World War I. 50 million dead in World War II. And a Europe left in ruins. Our book today, in this lecture, tells us about another age of civil war and destruction, and of widespread hopelessness, from which the entire Roman world was saved by one man who did his duty, Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, known to history as Augustus. And in our course on famous Romans, we examined the Aeneid briefly, for what it told us about the policies of Augustus. For it was written at his urging by the greatest poet of the day, by Virgil. Born in 70 BC, Virgil had grown up amidst that turmoil that first preceded and then followed the death of Julius Caesar. Virgil had witnessed the Roman world brought to political as well as economic ruin by a self-satisfied, self-aggrandizing group of politicians who sought only their own best interest, serving the vested interest of their day. And we saw in Julius Caesar, in Shakespeare, the play end with the death of great Caesar and then that of Brutus and Cassius, and the reader of Plutarch, the audience of Shakespeare, knew that this would lead only to a new round of civil war, on and on again, until finally, in 31 BC, with his ultimate victory over Mark Antony, once his friend and colleague, would Augustus, the young Octavian, triumph and prove himself to be the greatest statesman in history, building upon a ruined world, a new fabric, which guaranteed individual liberty and brought such peace and prosperity to the entire Roman world that it would not be equaled again until the 20th century of our own era. Augustus unleashed 2 centuries of unparalleled prosperity, peace, and intellectual creativity and social mobility. And he did this through a dictatorship. It was a carefully disguised dictatorship. It was a sugar-coated dictatorship. It was a dictatorship that left all of the old instruments of constitutional government in place, but one in which all real sinews of power, political, military, economic, were vested in the person of the great Augustus and then his successors as Caesars over Rome. And Virgil was urged by the great Augustus to write an epic poem which would, one, celebrate the foundation of Rome, and then, as an allegory, portray the great struggles that Augustus himself had undergone in order to bring peace and prosperity to the Roman world, to portray in allegorical form the labor of bringing about peace, the labors of Augustus. And in the person of Aeneas, we see Augustus. But let us focus upon Aeneas himself, this most noble figure to emerge from epic poetry, and the Aeneid itself, that work on which Virgil spent his last years, dying before it was completed, and urging his friend to burn it. But the friend, I believe wisely, and Augustus, saw to it that the work was published and became perhaps the most influential work of literature, as opposed to religious work, ever composed. Yes, it drew upon the lessons of great Homer, but all through the Middle Ages, the Western Europe did not read Greek, and it was Virgil who was the great master. And we will remember that Dante calls Virgil his great master. And it is Virgil who leads Dante through the Inferno and Purgatory. And Christians regarded Virgil as a noble pagan who had portrayed and foreshadowed the coming of Christ. The Aeneid is a great book in that it made literary history. It is a great book for its central theme, which is certainly how Rome was founded, the great task of founding Rome, but also its theme of duty. Do your duty, no matter what. Oh, and the language, the poetry of Virgil is unsurpassed. The English poet Tennyson paid tribute to Virgil on the anniversary of the poet's birth as the unsurpassed master of poetry. "I who have loved thee since my days began," said Tennyson, "since I first became alive intellectually, I have paid homage to you." It's great theme, it's great language. The question is, does it still speak across the ages? For it is a difficult poem, filled with mythological and historical references. And to those who might still become caught up in the carnage and bloodshed of the Iliad, the Aeneid might seem to have a quiet calm to it that sometimes makes it difficult for people to identify with its central figure of Aeneas. And some may very well be put off by Aeneas himself. "Sum pius Aeneas," "I am dutiful Aeneas," he introduces himself. And thus, contemporary classical scholars frequently try to suppress the real meaning of the Aeneid as a powerful statement of the propaganda of Augustus, as a celebration of absolute rule under a good and kind and dutiful leader. The war and warrior of the Aeneas, who as a leader, a primus, the same way that Augustus was a princeps, led his followers from the ruin of Troy to found a new Rome. Just as Augustus had led the Roman people through war and suffering to found a new order. Aeneas is the man of duty. That's a term and a concept that ought to cause us to pause a minute after having just read 1984 and discussed it. After all, isn't the interrogator O'Brien a man of duty? Isn't he carrying out his duty, fulfilling his responsibility by what he has to do to Winston? Now, take him apart from that, and he would just as soon not be there torturing Winston, having him beaten, sending these electric shocks through him. But his sense of duty, his fulfilling the will of the party, requires him to carry out these acts. This is what they said at Nuremberg. I was just carrying out orders, just fulfilling my duty. So what separates the man of conscience doing his duty from the colonel of the SS carrying out his duty? And Virgil would tell you it is the moral compass. It is a belief in absolute right and wrong, drawn from a belief in God. And the Aeneid is a deeply religious work. It is a poem that takes a belief in God and in the divine mission given by God to a man and to a nation very seriously. And in the first book, we find Aeneas at the very beginning, fato profugus, driven by fate, hurled along. First the fall of the great city of Troy, the loss of his family, his wife, the loss of what he had fought for, his nation of Troy going up in flames, and set adrift with a small remnant of Trojan men and women somehow to survive. And worse than that, pursued by the great goddess Juno, the wife of Jupiter, who is devoted to the mighty city of Carthage, and whose desire, deeply felt in her heart, is to see Carthage rule the world. And Juno knows that if Aeneas can see through and carry out his task, Rome will one day overcome and destroy Carthage. And you'll remember, of course, from our famous Romans, that is just what happened. First defeating the Carthaginians in two great wars, and then in 146, the Romans would burn that mighty city, the citadel of Juno, to the ground and sow its land with salt. Juno was thus determined to stop Aeneas from reaching Italy and founding a new Rome. And she sends a massive storm upon Aeneas and his men, sweeping them off their course and all but drowning them until they wash up on the shores of North Africa. And there we meet Aeneas, worn out, his men salt encrusted, their food all but destroyed, a wreck of a wrecked nation. He and his men will be taken in and comforted by the beautiful queen of Carthage, by Dido. And she urges Aeneas, this traveler from far away, whose fame as a warrior has preceded him, to tell about the great Trojan War and the capture of the city of Troy. You ask me to recall horror. You ask me, Aeneas says, to remember things I have tried to drive under my deepest, deepest pillow of memory. But I will tell of Troy, and he tells that sad story of the people who believed that victory was theirs, the Trojans, who believed that the Greeks had sailed away after 10 long years of war, and who brought into their city that ill-omened horse, that wooden horse, and thought it was a gift from the gods. It was a gift from the gods who had decided that Troy must be destroyed. And in the dark of night, the Greek heroes came down out of the horse. And Aeneas describes the horror of the flames and death on that one evening of destruction, and all of Troy falling down around him as the Trojans, sleeping away the drunken sleep of victory, were overwhelmed, many of them without even arms. And as he tried to carry his father out on his shoulders, remember old Anchises that Cassius described in the Julius Caesar play? He let go of his wife's hand, and his loved, deeply beloved wife, Creusa, vanished. He went back calling over and over again, "Creusa, Creusa, where are you?" But she was gone. His city torn away, his country destroyed, his wife gone. But he still had a duty. He didn't quite perceive it, but he knew at least he had a duty to that remnant of Trojans to get them away from this scene of destruction. And so they had sailed. From place to place, he tells Dido, the queen of Carthage, "We have sailed, and always we have been driven on. And always I have this urging that I must find a place of refuge where I can start a new Troy." And at the end of his tale of woe, Dido is overcome with love for the handsome Aeneas, for the man who has suffered so much, the man who is so courageous, so dutiful. And she gives herself to him. They become lovers. And more than that, she says, "Marry me, and you will be king over Carthage, this vast, powerful city that stands here on the shores of North Africa." Well, what's to stop him? His wife is gone. He has a son to raise. He has these people to take care of, and they will be well treated in Carthage. But that is not the will of the gods. Already in the first book, we have learned from Jupiter, supreme king of gods and men, in a promise to Venus, the mother of great Aeneas, the goddess of love, who fears that Aeneas will be destroyed and Rome will never be founded. Jupiter has promised her, "I will unroll for you," he says, "the book of fate. And in there you will see that to the Romans I have promised imperium sine fine, empire without end. There will neither be temporal nor spatial limits to the empire of Rome. Aeneas will found his city, and from that city will one day come the savior of the world, the great one, Augustus. That is my fixed promise to you, my daughter Venus, and to all the world." So Jupiter has promised that the Romans will have an empire without end, and Aeneas will found it. Thus, the messenger of the gods comes down to Aeneas and tells him, "Why are you delaying here? Get on with your task. Leave Carthage." Now, that's a torn path of duty, wouldn't you say? He has, after a fashion, married Dido. In fact, she's convinced they are legally wed. He loves her. She loves him. He has promised her, she thinks, that he will stay there forever. She has given him anything that he desired, and now he must leave. And I find Aeneas very human. He tries to avoid the confrontation. It's just going to slip away. She rushes down to the port where he's preparing to leave and says, "How could you do this to me? You're like a wild tiger that never had a mother. How can you punish me like this for all we have meant to each other?" And he says, "I was going to come and tell you, but just had to take care of these events." She says, "We're married." "No, we're not really. If you check the documents, we're not fully married," he says. "Now, I have to leave you. It is the will of the gods." The will of the gods. The gods honor truth, and they honor keeping your promises. "We must leave." And so he sails away. And as they sail out of the harbor of Carthage, they see a great fire breaking out. It is the very funeral pyre of Dido, who has gone back to her palace and killed herself out of the horror, pain she feels at the loss of her love. "Sum pius Aeneas, I am dutiful Aeneas. I must carry out my responsibility to the gods. I must fulfill the will of the gods. And on he and his men will sail through more trouble, more trial, until they finally land in Italy. They land on the shores of Cumae, the oldest Greek colony on the mainland of Italy, a place we could still visit today, still haunted, I believe, by the shades of Aeneas and the suffering his men had undergone. And we could go with Aeneas into the cave of the Sibyl, the priestess of Apollo, the prophetess who looked into the future. And Aeneas asked, when will there be an end to this suffering? When will this be over? And the news she gives him, echoing out of the 100 miles of the cave, is awe-inspiring. You must first go down into the underworld, into hell itself, and only there will you find the way to Rome. Into hell itself? Nobody goes down into hell. Well, no, Odysseus did. Well, he did, that's true. You will go, and I will lead you, says the Sibyl of Cumae, the priestess of Apollo. And this will be our talisman to carry us down, the golden bough. Break it off the tree, and one will grow back. And that will open the gates of hell for us. But let me warn you one thing, says the Cumaean Sibyl. The way down is easy. The way up is labor indeed. They go down, deep, deep into the bowels of the earth, having propitiated the gods of the underworld by mighty sacrifices. Down, down they go, down to the great river that runs through, the river Styx. And there the boatman, Charon, we met with Dante, refuses to take them across. You cannot take a living man across until they are shown the golden bough, this branch of the tree of Apollo broken off. And then he ferries them across. What is all of this? The Cumaean Sibyl is asked by Aeneas. Who are all these forms flitting around here? Lonely, isolated, desolate, like little shadows here across the river Styx. Those, says the Cumaean Sibyl, are those who died for love. Those who committed suicide out of a sense of lost honor, of desperation, sadness. There in the shadows, is that not? Yes, it is Dido. Dido, it's true then that you killed yourself? I didn't want to leave you. I loved you. Don't you understand? I have to follow my duty. She would not even speak to him. She only glared at him with hate-filled eyes and shrunk back to her old lost husband, dead so long ago. Please, just talk to me, says Aeneas. But she is gone, and the Cumaean Sibyl harshly says, move on, carry on down. What is that horrible, fire-filled area there, that river that goes on and on and on? That, says the Cumaean Sibyl, is the place of flames, the pit, where all those go who have committed sins too terrible ever to be redeemed. There are lawyers who betrayed their clients. There are those who scorn the gods, like Salmoneus, who dressed up as though he were Jupiter. There are those who abused their children. There they all burn forever and ever and ever. But leave that place of terror, those screams of horror, the groaning of souls in torment. And there, see over there? There is a lovely field. Ooh, it sounds as though bees are humming there. They are. Those are souls that are waiting to go back to the upper world. Souls that have lived. Souls that have paid for any crimes they committed. And now will go back and live again. Have another chance. And here to guide you through these beautiful fields is your father, Anchises. Dad, is it really you? How long I have been waiting for you, my son. How long have I been waiting to show you your fate, what following your duty will lead you to, what will result from your piety, your sense of honor and obligation and of duty, of courage that is all embodied in the Roman notion of pietas. Dad, you must explain to me, though, all of these figures flitting along here. Who are they? They are souls, as the Sibyl told you, who will go one day back up to live again. How is that possible? You must understand the very beginning of things, my son. For everything in the universe comes from God. It comes from a divine spirit, a divine soul, and divine reason. And they mingle together. And the divine spirit of God and the divine mind of God has given to every creature in the universe, from the flying things of the air to the creatures under the sea, to man himself and woman, a spark of the divine that is the soul, and laid upon them the obligation to live with justice. And that soul is what is divine. And the body encases it and weighs it down. And the body, through its desires and lust, its ambition, it leads people to do bad acts. And when we die, we come down here to the underworld, where each one of us is judged for each of our actions. And some who have lived an absolutely pure life will go up and join the stars and never suffer a body again. But others who have committed crimes or just lesser sins or indiscretions, just perhaps putting aside a task that needed to be done until it was too late, they will have to pay. Some, for example, are stretched out like clothes upon a clothesline until the winds blow them free of their sins. Each one of us, Anchises says to his son, must pay the appointed penalty for what we have done. Ponder that. Each one of us must pay the appointed penalty for what we have done. And then, our souls cleansed, we are sent back up to live another life. Why are they gathered at that river? They are drinking from the river of forgetfulness, so that they will not recall their previous life, but think that they are newborn. Now, my son, enough of that. Look at what God has foreshadowed for you. And Aeneas sees, under the guidance of his father, the long line of the glory of Rome. His own son, who will one day found a mighty city, through Romulus, the founder of Rome, through the great warriors of Rome like Scipio, who will drag Carthage down in defeat, and culminating with the figure of Augustus, who will bring peace to the world and extend the borders of the Roman Empire to the frontiers of the world. Great Augustus, that is what will come of your following your duty. So Aeneas, now understanding the will of the gods, understanding that his sense of duty is indeed right, that what he is doing is just because it rests upon the will of the gods, will go back out of the underworld, newborn, a new man, understanding his mission is not to refound Troy, but to create a new and mighty nation. And that will give him the courage to wage war once again, a seemingly unnecessary war in Italy, brought upon by the jealousy and evil will of those who would thwart the destiny of Rome. And he will lead his men into battle after battle after battle, all through the final part of the Aeneid, until finally victory is his. And the last victory is won when, sword and spear in hand, he overcomes the source of the war and rebellion, the mighty Etruscan warlord and Turnus. And just as the Achilles has overcome Hector, Aeneas must overcome this final resistance to the will of the gods in the form of Turnus. And as he has overcome Turnus, Turnus is there begging for his life. And Aeneas understands that he must be killed. And he does his duty. And the final line of the Aeneid is the soul of Turnus squeaking away down into the underworld. To the very end, Aeneas fulfills that duty, no matter how hard and painful it is. Sum pius Aeneas, I am Aeneas, the man of duty.